class is not about getting rich. Right. It has nothing to do with getting rich. It has to do with restoring hope.
I think that using credit cards just makes your life that much more stressful.
I wasn't disciplined enough to go ahead and pay it off once I did use it for emergencies. My debt just lingered on and on and on.
I'm up to paying $681 a month on these things to make them go, hopefully go away someday.
When I finally pay it off, this bill, I was sitting here looking at the MasterCard and I said, now I can cut your behind.
How do you wean yourself away from credit? And this program helps you do that.
In order to be spiritually free, you've got to be financially free as well.
Having financial peace just takes the everyday stress off your life. You're not having to worry about your credit cards. You're not having to worry about your car payments. You're not having to worry about everything. Right. When you can get that off your shoulders, you're living life a lot better. Mm-hmm.
Emotional. I'm mad now. You know, I want to get debt free now, and it's different for me this time.
Yeah, it's satisfying not to get bills in the mail, but it'd be more satisfying to have a boat or a convertible. But you just got to sort of grow up.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome nationally syndicated radio host and best-selling author Dave Ramsey.
An important lesson in this particular session. This is one that matters. This is probably the subject I am best known for and probably the most passionate about, because this is the lesson that sets you free to be able to accomplish all the things we've been talking about, to accomplish some real financial peace, to be able to really accomplish some wealth building, to be able to really accomplish some actual dollars, to give yourself some security, to give your family tree a change of direction, to give yourself a complete new legacy. And it starts right here. It really does start with this subject. This subject is a tough subject, though. It's tough to teach because anytime you teach people something they don't believe, well, they kind of tend to throw you away. I mean, what I sell for a living are ideas. And when I try to pitch an idea that's perpendicular to what you believe, it's real easy for you to write nutcase across my forehead and just go, this guy's crazy. And what I'm going to teach you in this lesson is tough to swallow. I'll challenge you ahead of time to try to stay open for a few minutes and try to receive these ideas. If you think I'm crazy, that's fine. On the way home, just write nutcase on my forehead. I can deal with that. But for a few minutes, on the off chance that I might be right, I want you to stay very carefully with these ideas, because I think I've got something here. I think I'm on to something. As a matter of fact, I know I am. If you'll open your workbooks to the dumping debt lesson and be prepared to write and fill in the blanks as we go along, like we do in every one of the lessons, we're going to put the answers to those blanks up on the screen. What I want to talk to you about tonight is I want to debunk a myth, a series of myths that flow out of a major concept, and we have bought these myths as truth. The thing I have found about myths is that if you tell a lie, spread a myth often enough, loud enough, long enough, the myth eventually becomes accepted as truth. If you just say it over and over and over again, and all of your friends believe it, and your relatives believe it, and everyone thinks this is the way it is, then eventually we go, well, we must be crazy. And eventually we will conform and we will accept that myth, even though it's not the truth. Even though we know somewhere deep down inside of our soul, inside of our spirits, that we're heading the wrong direction. Even though that's the situation, we will eventually conform and go along. What I want to talk to you about tonight is I believe debt is dumb. I believe debt is not a method to becoming prosperous. And most Americans today believe you have to have debt to win. I'm here to tell you, I think debt is stupid. I think it's wrong, and I don't think it's the shortest, quickest, easiest method to prosperity. And I'm going to walk you through and show you exactly what I'm talking about. What we're talking about here is debt is a product, and it has been marketed to us so aggressively since the late 1960s that to even imagine living without debt requires a complete paradigm shift. You have to change the way you look at things completely. You see, I want to remind you of something. Debt has not always been a way of life. It has not always been the way things were purchased. You see, your great-grandparents thought debt was a sin. They thought it was wrong. As a matter of fact, the Sears catalog, now imagine this. The Sears catalog from 1910 says that buying on credit is folly. Now, is that backwards or what? I mean, that's incredible. As a matter of fact, James Cash Penny, J.C. Penny, did not allow credit to be offered in his stores while he was alive. It was only after his death that credit and credit cards became a part of J.C. Penny's, as we know it today. And he's spinning somewhere in his grave. No question about that. Henry Ford hated debt so much that he made Ford Motor Company wait 10 years to offer financing on vehicles. He firmly believed you should not buy a vehicle if you couldn't pay for it. Ford Motor Company came in 10 years after General Motors into the financing business because of Henry Ford's personal disdain for debt. Now, his children and his VPs and all these others pressured him, and eventually Ford Motor Credit is a huge operation, obviously, much like Sears has become a huge credit operation. Our great-grandparents thought debt was a sin. Our grandparents thought it was really dumb, and they took debt out on just a few things. In 1950, there was this little thing born, a little piece of plastic. A man who we call the grandfather of the credit card, named Jim McNamara, opened a company in 1950 and got the first wide acceptance across store lines in New York City of a little piece of plastic called a credit card. His company name was Diners Club. And that's the first time the credit card was born. Later, in 1958, is when we see a little company on the West Coast, a little bank there in San Francisco called the Bank of America. And they did a mailing of 60,000 to their members, to their participants, to their customers, offering for the first time a piece of plastic called the Bank AmeriCard there in 1958. Also, of course, in 1958, American Express was born, and now American Excess is a way of life. Our parents thought debt was dumb, but they began to take it out on a few more things. They borrowed a few more. Did you know in 1970... only 15% of Americans carried plastic. The credit card is a fairly recent phenomenon. And credit card debt at the level that it's at is a fairly recent phenomenon. In 1976, Bank AmeriCard had expanded all across North America and changed its name to what we know it now as Visa. In 1986, Sears was in a big dispute with Visa because they couldn't get the discounts that they wanted. There was a big war in the credit industry, so they decided they would take Visa on head on. And in 1986, they opened a thing called the Discover Card. It quickly became the most profitable division of Sears. And later, when Sears got in financial problems, the sale of the Discover Card helped save them and keep them away from bankruptcy. This is just a little history of credit. I think it's kind of interesting to look back and say Discover has only been around since 1986, and yet it's so ingrained in our culture that to even imagine living without debt requires a complete paradigm shift. See, it keeps going, of course. You understand that today, while Sears in 1910 said buying on credit was a folly, today Sears has over 1 million applications a month go out. Today, Sears, for the last 9-10 years, according to their own publicly traded report, has made more money net profit on the sale of credit than they have on the sale of merchandise. Now, I'm not mad at Sears. They've got some great tools. I buy them at the flea market all the time. But now, Sears, you know, Sears, what really, they are not a merchandising operation. They're a credit operation because that's where they make the most of their money, with some stuff out front. This is absolutely not a game. Credit card issuers sent out 4.2 billion pieces of mail last year. See, credit debt, as we know it, is a product. See, when you go into the furniture store and they come up and say, "Can I help you, please?" You always say, "Oh, no, I'm just looking." But when you go into the bank, they are selling a product. I got bad news. Banks are not nonprofit organizations. They sell debt. And when we go into the bank, we don't say, "Oh no, I'm just looking." We say, "Please, I want one of each." How many of you own your own business or sell for a living? Wouldn't it be neat if Monday morning when you got to your office, on one knee was a line of people outside going, "Please sell me your stuff." That's a wonderful marketing job. Banks have done such a wonderful marketing job that their product is now a part of our culture. Now, I'm not angry with banks. When Dave Ramsey went broke, it was Dave Ramsey's fault. It was not a bank's fault. I signed up for the trip. But I am now what's called an awakened and an aware consumer, which makes me dangerous. I perceive these things a little bit differently. You see, our great-grandparents thought debt was a sin. Our grandparents borrowed on a few things. Our parents on a few more things. And we borrow on everything. I mean, you can get 90 days, same as cash, at the pet store on your dog. You know? "Come here, baby. Repo man's here." It is wild out there. We borrow on everything, don't we? So my goal in this session is to give you a paradigm shift, a belief system shift, a different way of looking at things. Let's play with that for just a second. If you'll look at your screen, what you'll see, well, I want to ask you. You remember, you need to play my games with me. So how many of you see a candlestick or a vase in the middle? Look up there until you see that. I'll wait until everyone sees it and raises their hand. We'll wait on you. Look carefully. Do you see it? Good. Now, how many people see two people looking at each other? Good. Now, how many people see two people getting ready to kiss? Sex fiends. Okay, now. It's a paradigm. It's your way of looking at things. Now, you probably saw one or the other first, and now that you've seen all three, you've had a different way of looking at things. Let's look at another one. This one's really hard to see, so you have to look carefully. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is slave to the lender. What happens to us is we get out of school, we get out of college or high school, and we get married, right? No, this is not marriage. And Sharon and I got out. We were driving a 1902 Pinto, eating off of a card table. You remember, we ain't got money, honey, but we got love. And it's a good thing, too, because we ain't got no money. You remember the drill. And I had a little bit of a student loan debt and a little bit on an Amoco card. Now, I'm not sure you're supposed to be able to buy a couch on your Amoco card, but I did once. Says a little bit about the neighborhood I grew up in, possibly. I don't know. And we started our life. You remember that. Sharon's driving that little Pinto, and I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember, but back in those days, those Pintos used to blow up upon contact. And so Sharon's driving this blow-up mobile, and my buddies are making fun of me. They're going, "I bet you got good life insurance on her." Well, I got all embarrassed, and I went and bought my woman a car that I wanted. And I went down to the stereo store because we needed a television. We needed a television. The one we had to watch like this. We got it at a garage sale. And so I got a television, but I didn't get just any television. I was a finance major, so I got 90 days, same as cash. Oh, you did it too. And I didn't get just any television. I got a stereo television, which meant I had to get a stereo with big speakers that I couldn't pronounce the name, but they were really loud, so I knew they were good ones. And of course, with the stereo came the turntable and the all the different accoutrements that go with that. And of course, the wonderful entertainment center. And so we're living in a one-bedroom apartment eating off a card table, but we have a stereo system that will shake an eight-block area. priorities, baby, priorities, right? And our friends came over and they're looking around, they're going, well, you know, you've been married now for 9 whole months and you don't own a home yet. You need to own a home. Buying a home is smart. Throwing money down a rat hole is what renting is. You are renting, and they're looking at our apartment going, rat hole, rat hole, rat hole. You're throwing your money down a rat hole. Well, we didn't know about rats or rat holes, but we knew it wasn't a good place to put money. And so we started looking for a home. Well, I was in the real estate business. So we found and purchased our first home. Nothing down. Creative financing. When you look up creative financing in the Greek, it means too broke to buy a house. So we bought a home in the same neighborhood as I grew up in. Larry Burkett says that we spend the first 5 to 7 years of our marriage trying to attain the same standard of living as our parents. Only it took them 35 years to get there. There's only one way to get all that stuff, and that's get a whole bunch of debt to go with it, because you don't have any money. I know the drill. Sad thing is, in the first 7 years of marriages in North America, 52% of them are now ending in divorce. And of those divorces that occur in the first 7 years, 90% say money problems caused it. You know why? It's no fun being married like this. We have people come in our office all the time like this. They're going, Dave, my leg's tired. Can you get me out, please? It takes all the joy out of the deal, doesn't it? It's destroying our families because the borrower is truly slave to the lender. Well, Sharon and I, we made a decision. We decided that that wasn't fun. We went broke, lost everything we owned, and started again at the bottom. And we said, what of these we still have on at that point? We're going to get them off. And we worked like crazy people. We went nuts. I worked 100 hours a week. Our kids thought Oshkosh Bagosh came from a garage sale. We wore used clothing. We drove old beat up junky cars. We had no fun. We didn't go on vacation. But I'll tell you what, we got rid of the payments. You know what you can do if you don't have any payments? Whew. I mean, I don't have a house payment. I don't have a car payment. I don't have a MasterCard payment. I don't have a student loan that's been around so long you think it's a pet. I don't struggle with trying to figure out what I'm going. Do you know how much money you have to make to eat when you don't have any payments? You know how fast you can build wealth when you don't have any payments? But Dave, oh, I know. There's always the but Dave's, so let's address a few of those. Let's look at some of the myths that are spread in North America today. Myth number one, if I loan money to a friend or relative, I will be helping them. The truth is that the relationship will be strained or destroyed. Myth number one, no more. Hate to pop your balloon, but that's the way this works. How many of us have loaned money to a friend or relative only to find out later that they will never call you back? I mean, the old joke is, if you loan $20 to your brother-in-law and he won't call you back, was it worth it? You know? The truth is, that's probably not funny. How many parents are split from their grown kids over a loan? How many times do parents think they're blessing their children by loaning them money? I'm going to make them responsible. See, what you did is you just changed it from father-son, from mother-son, mother-daughter, father-daughter, to master-servant. Thanksgiving dinner tastes different when you're eating with your master than when you're eating with your dad and mom. While they're nice, I was never mean to them. I never put pressure on them. Doesn't matter. The relationship was changed in the spiritual, and it's not up to you to decide how that works. The borrower is slave to the lender. When you loan a friend $20, you just changed your relationship with them. When you loan them $2,000, you just changed your relationship with them. We all know that to be true, don't we? How many of us have damaged relationships over money? Two or three people admitting it, and the rest of them going, well, should I say he's sitting near me, you know? myth by co-signing a loan. I am helping out a friend or relative. Truth. The bank requires a co-signer because the person isn't likely to repay. Duh! So be ready to pay the loan and have your credit messed up because you are really, at the end of the day, responsible for that loan. And they will hold you responsible. The Bible actually talks about this in Proverbs 17:18, the New Contemporary English Version. It says it's stupid to guarantee someone else's loan. I like that version. If you want a little lighter version, you can always look at the New King James Version, which says, one lacking in sense signs surety for another. It's a really nice way of saying you were stupid. If you co-sign a loan for your children, you're not blessing them. You're bringing them into this master-servant relationship and fully expect to have problems with any loans that are co-signed. If the banks who are aggressively marketing this product, putting out as much of their product as they can, called debt, won't loan these people money, it could be because there's a problem. Think about it. You're not blessing them. If you want to help your friend, if you want to help your relative, and you have the money, give it to them. Give it to them. And when they want to give it back, say the only obligation you have is to help someone else later. And pass it on. Tell them they have to pass it on. But don't put yourself in a master servant. Don't set those expectations that someone who a banker knows statistically is not going to repay, you set expectations on them that they're going to. You're kidding yourself. Myth. Cash advance, rent to own, title pawning, and tote the note lots are needed services for lower income people to get ahead. Truth, these are horrible, greedy ripoffs that aren't needed and benefit no one but the person that owns the company. Myth debunked. See, what you've got to understand is when you drive off of a military base, those young military people, these people serving our country, you know what greets them as they come off the military base? Pawn shops, cash advance places, everything. Rent to own is 1,800% effective yield on that money. How come those things are not lined up down through the rich neighborhood? Rich people don't need it. No, rich people wouldn't buy it. That's what made them rich. You see, what I figured out is this. It's really simple. If I'm a poor person, I do rich people stuff, I get rich. If I'm a rich person, I do poor people stuff, I get poor. Mike Todd said it well. He says, I have never been poor. I've only been broke. Poor is a state of mind. See, I don't care whether you're a man. I don't care whether you're a woman. I don't care whether you're black, purple, green, white, Republican. At the end of the day, you do poor people stuff, you will be poor. You do rich people stuff, you will be rich. It takes some time. It's not easy. But if you quit thinking, thank God it's Friday, oh God it's Monday, and you quit living week to week, and start thinking out there and having a vision and saying, I'm going somewhere with this, so I'm not borrowing money at 800% interest at some rip-off tote the note situation or some cash advance thing. I'm not going to do poor people stuff. You see, I've been broke twice in my life. I started broke and I went broke again. Twice in my life, before I was 40 years old, I had a net worth of $1 million. It can be done in America. I did it better the second time. Hopefully we'll keep it this time. That's the game plan, right? But if you want to build wealth, look around and figure out not what television says, not what your friend's opinion is, not what your mama who has two nickels to rub together said, but look at what rich people are doing. Do rich people stuff, you get rich. Do poor people stuff, you get poor. Now, it will take some time, and yes, there are barriers, and yes, there are things that smack each one of us around, but if you keep doing rich people stuff long enough, you will build wealth. But if you think for a moment that you can play these games that a lot of people in lower income neighborhoods play and end up anywhere but in that neighborhood the rest of your life, you're kidding yourself. Many people rise up out of middle class or out of lower class into upper class. 90% of America's millionaires are first generation rich. They started with basically nothing. Well, they had no, they didn't. They did rich people stuff. They didn't go fleece their cars. They didn't go up to their eyeballs in credit card debt. And they didn't go down and play the lotto. Playing the lotto or other forms of gambling will make me rich. Myth. Truth. Lotto and Powerball are a tax on the poor and a tax on people who can't do math. Well, it's not a religious statement. It's a statistical fact. Let's think through this. How come it is when I stop at the market in another state, I was down there the other day, and these people are lined up to buy these lotto tickets? How come it is that Daryl and his other brother Daryl are all that's in line? You don't see rich people standing in this line. There's not a bumper-to-bumper traffic jam of Mercedes, Jaguars, and Lexuses out there to get these lotto tickets. I wonder why. Because you have a better statistical chance of rolling out of bed, hitting a chihuahua, and causing brain cancer than hitting one of those lotto tickets. Think, people. It's a tax on the poor. That's who plays it. Rich people don't play it. Why? Because they know it doesn't work. You see, the average lotto player in North America plays between $25 and $40 a month into that game. I took as an example the average of that around $32 a month. If you invest $32 a month in a decent growth stock mutual fund from age 20 to age 70, your working lifetime, the same amount that the average person that plays the lotto puts it in into a mutual fund, $32, through that whole period of time, you will have $1,250,000 every time. Not one in 800 million, every time. Think. The bad news is it's not up to me, it's up to you. You've got to do this stuff. No one's going to come in and just appear and start handing you money. The bad news is Ed McMahon is not coming. Okay? That's the real world. Myth. Car payments are a way of life. I'll always have a car payment. You'll always have a car payment, so you might as well drive one with a nice car. Truth. Staying away from car payments by driving reliable used cars is what the typical millionaire does. That's how they became millionaires. Myth debunked. See, what you need to remember is this. We love our cars in North America. I like cars. Boys like cars. I think it's a genetic thing. Some of you girls like cars too, but you like them for different reasons. You think they're just a really large purse. Boys like cars. I know this because I have a son, and when my son was little, we could lock him in a room with just two coat hangers, and he would come out with a car and a gun. It's a genetic thing. Boys like cars. Americans love our cars. We are what we drive in North America, aren't we? I mean, you judge people on what they drive. Your friend can buy a $700,000 home, and you're not nearly as impressed as if they buy a $28,000 car. You're like, whoa, he's got it going. Look at George. Go, George. You know? And George is broke. But he's got a good car. You know what I mean? Got big, old, hairy car payments, but you're all impressed. Isn't that amazing? And you are what you drive. You see people, I see them getting out of their cars around the shopping mall. I look at them. I saw a guy got out the other day. He's like, I am a Lexus. Saw another guy get out of a $100 pickup, and he's like, I'm a $100 pickup. You are what you drive. You assign an identity to what we drive. You judge people based on that. Oh, they're a Taurus. Getting ready to start the family, are we? You know, you judge things based on what's going on with that particular family in that situation based on what they drive. USA Today says the average car payment in North America today is $378 over 55 months. If you take that car payment and keep it all your life and were to instead invest it, guess what, in a good growth stock mutual fund from age 25 to age 65, $378 would be $4.4 million. Hope you like the car. Now, I like cars, though. I'm just like you. The next myth about cars is that leasing your car is what sophisticated financial people do. You should always lease things that go down in value. And besides that, Dave, there are tax advantages. Truth, Consumer Reports, Smart Money Magazine, and a good calculator will tell you that a car lease is the most expensive way to finance and operate a vehicle. We call it car fleecing. Smart Money Magazine recently did an article on it where they quoted the National Auto Dealers Association as saying when the typical new car dealer sells a brand new car for cash, their average nationally profit is $82. They make more money in the garage than they do anywhere else on the new car lot. The second most profitable place is in the finance manager's office. Because, see, what happens is if you buy the car instead of for cash on payments, what the averages, according to this article, are, they take that contract of those payments that you're supposed to pay and they sell it to a bank or to their own home office, General Motors Acceptance, GMAC, right? Or to Ford Motor Credit or Lexus Credit or Toyota Credit or wherever you are, right? When they sell that contract, the dealer makes more profit on the sale of that contract than they did on the car. As a matter of fact, instead of making $82 on the car, they'll average about $775 on traditional payments. If instead they can get you to fleece the car, there's much more profit and room in a fleece, which means it's less good for you. And so they average about $1,300 a vehicle on the sale of a fleeced car. Consequently, guess what they push? 78% of the BMWs that go off the lot this year will be fleeced. That's according to a friend of mine, and I won't say what he does there. This is not a game, gang. We have to wake up and stop and think about that. The truth is, if you own a business and you did the fleece because it was a great write-off, you need to stop and think about how this stuff works a little bit. See, I have a paid-for car. I can write my car off either on mileage on my taxes, or I can just do a depreciation of that vehicle. If it's an expensive car with without a bunch of miles going on it, which is what I have, I do a straight line depreciation method. If you have a cheaper car in your business and you're running the wheels off of it, you're better off to take the mileage. In either case, you'll have a better tax situation than you will with the car fleece. You have to go through 7 different tables in the tax code to make sure that all of the car fleece that you're writing off is accurately done. If not, be prepared to write some checks when you are audited. This is not a game. But the myth that goes around is that somehow you're very smart, wise, and sophisticated if you fleece your car. Bad idea. Okay? Don't go there. The truth is, the way to minimize the money lost on things that go down in value is to buy that item slightly used, thereby letting the person before you take the hit. Think about it. Myth. I can get a great deal, a good deal, on a new car. I don't think so. A new car, according to Kiplinger's Personal Money Management magazine, will lose about 60% of its value in the first 4 years that you own this thing. So we take a $28,000 vehicle. On average, this car is going to lose about $16,800 of its value in the first 4 years. A four-year-old $28,000 car is going to be worth about $11,200. So you're losing, if you're driving that car brand new, about $350 a month in value. So what you need to do is, as you're driving to work, roll down the window about once a week and let 100 slip out to try to get the effect of what's going on. Brand new cars go down in value like a rock. Buy a 1 or a 2-year-old, slightly used car. Let someone else take the tail kicking in depreciation. Well, Dave, I want a brand new car. Great. Become extremely wealthy. I have a friend of mine who makes $700,000 a year, has a net worth of $10 million. Now, this guy came to me the other day. He says, Dave, I'm thinking about buying a $50,000 brand new car. Do you think that's okay? I said, sure, go get you one. Understand that $50,000 out of $700,000 is about like you throwing away a grand. See, think about the percentages on this. It doesn't even affect his situation. He's become so wealthy, it doesn't matter. So if you want to drive a brand new car, then get in that kind of a condition. Had a guy call me on the radio a while back. He said, Dave, I want to buy a brand new Harley. $24,000, baby. I mean, I need this motorcycle, and I'm just posed. I'm ready. I'm ready to pounce, right? I'm ready to attack this guy right here on the radio. I said, so how much do you make a year? He said, $600,000. Go buy the Harley, man. You know? But see, a car is the largest thing we buy that goes down in value. Now, you got to understand, I love cars. I'm just like you. My next door neighbor pulled in the other day in one of these Cadillac Escalades. You know, Tahoe with an attitude. Oh, man, I could smell the leather from my driveway. I need this car. I'll tell you what, too. I got to tell y'all the truth. I mean, it's time to come clean. You know, if you ever listen to my radio show, sometimes, some days, it's like the sell the car show. You know, it's like, and what's your problem? Oh, sell the car. Dave, I make $32,000 a year. I have a $27,000 car. What do you think? Sell the car. You think I should sell the car? Yeah, sell the car. You know, half the time, because most of the time when they call in, it's this huge portion of the mess that they've made, isn't it? That's how it works out in our finances. It's one of those stupid tax things we all get into because we love our cars. And I'm just like you. I love cars, but I got to tell you all the truth. I got to come clean. The truth is that I've got it bad. I need one of these brand new Ford Expedition Eddie Bauer package, black on black, yeah, leather interior, seat heaters. Oh. Little blinkers on the thing, you know, out there. I need the CD player in the back that just changes them for like two generations. I never have to touch a button. Might hurt my finger, you know. I that leather smell. Moon hole in the top. It's so bad. And you want a black one, right? That's what Henry Ford said. You get a black car. That's the only color made, right? And man, those things are sweet. Big time. We're talking like $47,000, $48,000 sticker with all the goodies on it. This is a babe of a car. It's a sweetheart. It's so bad, my kids are like, there's that car daddy likes. Well, I got to be honest with y'all. I got to tell the truth. Because there's one thing I'm not. It's a hypocrite. Sort of. I came home on my birthday the other day. And in my driveway is a brand new Eddie Bauer Ford Expedition, black on black, rally wheels. It's red ribbon around it, sticker in the window. We're talking CD player in the back, moon hole in the top, leather smell. I went in the house, I told my wife, I said, I said, Sharon, do you ever listen to this radio program? I said, honey, them people are going to kill me. I said, can you say hypocrite? You know? And she said, but honey, you always drive those old cars and you're always trying to make a seminar point. Why don't you just live? You got financial pieces. You know you want it. I'm like, well, I got to tell y'all the truth. I got to be straight with you. We prayed about it. We thought about it. We pondered it. We decided to keep it. So I brought it to show you. True story. This was in the driveway. little red ribbon around it. My wife is a sick puppy. She thought that was funny. I drive a really nice 2-year-old car with about 40,000 miles on it. No, it's a 4-year-old car. Now, I bought it when it was 2 years old with 23,000 miles on it. I bought it so cheap I could just about sell it today for what I bought it for. But I kind of like it, so I think I'll just keep it. But I paid for it. That's the idea. Myth. The home equity loan is good because of the tax deduction and is a substitute for an emergency fund. Truth. You don't go into debt for emergencies, and a tax deduction is not good math. Let's think about this for a second. Let's do a little math. You guys help me. If I make a $50,000 loan at 10% interest, my interest on that home equity loan on $50,000, if it's 10%, the interest check that I wrote to the bank that year was how much money?
$5,000.
Now, what a tax deduction says is, if I take that $5,000 as a tax deduction, I take it off of my income. If I made $65,000, I take the $5,000 deduction off. I have to pay taxes on $60,000. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, if I didn't have the $5,000 tax deduction, I would have to pay taxes on $5,000 more, correct?
Yes.
If I am in a 25% tax bracket, 25% of the $5,000 would go out in taxes. Is that correct?
Yes.
So my tax bill on $5,000 would be $1,250. What a tax deduction some of these brilliant CPAs tell you to go in and to debt to get says is we're going to send the bank $5,000 to keep from sending Washington $1,250. Yeah, really, think about it. It'll come to you. Here's an idea. Why don't you give the $5,000 to the Red Cross or to your church, take the tax deduction, you got the exact same mathematical process, and you don't have to go in debt to do it. Never thought of that one. See, that's what a tax deduction is. You take the tax deductions if they're there anyway. I certainly don't want to pay any more taxes than are absolutely necessary. But I don't go create tax deductions by creating unneeded expenses or use that as a rationalization to stay in debt because it's bad mathematics. Myth, I'll take out a 30-year mortgage and I promise I'll pay extra. Truth, sick children, bad transmissions, prom dresses, downsizing, high utilities this month, do I really need to go on? No one ever pays extra every month. Never take out more than a 15-year fixed rate loan. Myth, I'll pay extra. The FDIC did a study that says on average 97.3% of the people do not systematically prepay a 30-year mortgage. It's a lie. You fully intended to, but one of the things you have to do is you have to stop lying to yourself. You have to trick yourself into having discipline. The cool thing about a 15-year mortgage is every single time it'll pay off in 15 years or sooner. No tricks. You always make the payment, too. But isn't it a lot more? Not really. We take a $90,000 house with $10,000 down. You have an $80,000 mortgage amount. On 30 years, the payments are $702 at 10% interest. Now, that interest may or may not apply today, but that's been the average over the last several many years. Now, 15 years, your payment would be $859. So you pay only $157 more on an $80,000 mortgage at 10% interest. The difference, though, is over 30 years, you pay back $252,000. Over 15 years, you only pay back $154,000. With a 15-year mortgage, you save 15 years of bond and $100,000. So why do we get 15-year mortgages? Why do we get 30-year mortgages? Why don't we have 17-year mortgages? Why don't we have 23-year mortgages? Where'd the 30 come from anyway? No one seems to know where it started. But we're all doing it. 30-year mortgage, 30-year mortgage. We're doing it because everyone else did it. It's the old story Zig Ziglar tells about the ham. He was out selling and he won a prize ham in a sales contest. He came home with the ham. He gave it to his wife. She immediately cut the good end of the ham off and began to put it in the pan. He said, "Why did you cut the end of my nice ham off?" She said, well, that's the way my mama always did it. He said, well, let's call and ask the crazy woman why she cuts the end of the ham off. They called his mother. She says, I don't know why I cut the end of the ham off. Always my mom always did that. Let's call her. Sure enough, they get on a conference call. They call grandma. Everybody's on the phone. Daughter, granddaughter are saying, mom, why is it a family tradition that we cut the end off of the ham? Grandma says, well, I don't know why you idiots are doing it, but my pan was too short. Why are we doing 30-year mortgages? Because everyone else always did it that way. Why didn't we just start out with a mentality of 15? Someone dreamed this up somewhere along the line, and the federal government decided to guarantee it in the form of a Federal Housing Administration loan, an FHA loan, or a VA loan, a Veterans Administration loan, and suddenly 30-year mortgages were a way of life. And no one ever stopped to go, I wonder why. Until I went broke and I decided I'm never going to not say I wonder why again. We're always going to wonder why. Myth: it is good to take out an adjustable rate mortgage or a balloon mortgage because I know I'll be moving. Truth: you will be moving when they foreclose.